Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
We've done the vast majority of legislative bills. There are a few left that are either going to be finished up in conference committee or final amendments that are being worked on. But for the most part, we are ahead and almost done with the legislative work.
Congress has ceded this territory to the president, and we're taking it back because it's really Congress that should have to vote before tariffs of this nature are implemented.
We're taking a whole government approach here. I think it's been very productive. We've moved the needle, and quite frankly, we're going to get this thing resolved.
I think it sends a signal to institutions that it's perfectly okay and acceptable to ignore constitutional rights, ignore civil rights.
Donald Trump promised to deport criminals and secure the border, and that's not what this is. And people who are following the rules shouldn't be penalized for following the rules. That's not going to keep us safer.
No, sir, they're not photos. They've meant the world to the individuals at the Department of Homeland Security. They have meant the world to our ICE agents,
really
our border agents.
Handling.
And joining me to talk about state lawmakers taking another break in their session, the case of the so-called fake electors heading back to a grand jury, and more, are Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's start with this, the so-called fake electors case. Attorney General Chris Mays, Marcus, had brought this case against 11 people who signed as what they say alternate slate of electors. This is, of course, going back to the 2020 election, saying that Donald Trump actually won Arizona's 11 electoral votes. But it seems like, at least for now, the work that Mays and her prosecutors have put in, they got to go back to square one.
Yeah, the judge said, you didn't include this document and to the jurors, and that was important to the case, and so you've got to go back and start scratch at step one. And the timeline's really tight. So this one has a long way to go, but we're going to have some resolution in a relatively short amount of time. I think it was 2 weeks that they gave her.
Yeah, I mean, Reginald, I mean, obviously there are legal machinations that have to happen with the stipulation that we are in this room not lawyers. Practically speaking, is that the end of this case, do you think?
You know, I think the name of the game right now for those who've been indicted is, how can you run off the clock up into the election? That's the name of the game. Try to continue to prolong, and hope that, Attorney General Mays isn't reelected so they could, get a attorney general that would be more favorable to them and essentially drop the case. But the implications of what happens in this next ruling is going to be wide ranging. Not only what happens here in Arizona, but you had other cases in Georgia, Michigan, and what happens here will be used across courtrooms throughout this United States.
Yeah, do you agree with that, Marcus? That what happens here could impact similar cases in other places?
I think it could. Although I'm not familiar enough at how these cases are being fleshed out in Michigan and Georgia and other states. So, it's certainly going to make a headline. I can tell you that much, but I don't think it will necessarily impact the legal process of those cases in those other states.
And, Reginald mentioned the election coming up. And of course, if Attorney General Chris Mays is reelected, that maybe changes the calculus, but it seems like there is at least some amount of strategy here of hoping on the part of the folks who've been indicted that Mays is not the attorney general for much longer, and that whoever comes in behind her, presumably a Republican, will say, no thanks, we're done.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the most likely scenario. And I think Republicans sort of feel the wind at their sails, if you will, going into this election, into this midterm. And so, it's certainly a strategy that makes sense and they would use.
All right, Reginald, another legal maneuvering happening this week. A couple of abortion rights groups have filed suit to ask a judge to do away with a number of abortion-related laws in Arizona. This includes a 24-hour waiting period, a ban on telehealth for abortion procedures. Also, there's a law that says abortions are not allowed if the main reason is because of a genetic difference. This is something that that abortion rights groups have been talking about doing for a while, right? To, in their mind, align all of the laws in the state with regard to abortion with the constitutional amendment that was approved in November.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so right now, I think it's important to know that you have a number of individuals throughout this state who decided, you know, to go to the ballot box and say, you know, what restrictions do we want and what restrictions don't we want when it comes to abortion and abortion rights? You know, when you talk about, you know, ultrasounds and telemedicine, these are things that in order to have an abortion, like these are not prerequisites that you need to go through. I mean, in many cases, these are things that are intended to make it much more difficult for individuals to go through and have abortions. But I do think that it is going to be important to get off the books, you know, things that have not been in line where voters are today. And it's going to be important for us to make sure that the rights ultimately of women are going to be protected.
I want to ask you about, obviously, there is a human element to an abortion for the people who are involved, the women involved. But I'm wondering also about the political implications here. This is a political show, after all. You know, lawsuits tend to move sort of at their own speed. Is there a chance that this also brings abortion back as an issue in 2026?
You know, I mean, I feel like the conversation around abortion has been one that's happened over the last several cycles. I mean, you're always going to talk about, you know, health care and women's health. That's going to be an issue, as it should be, when you have things such as, you know, Medicaid and a whole number of issues related to health that are front and foremost. But I ultimately think that for some folks, you know, they're going to want to make sure that at the end of the day that, you know, that women and health care and abortion is a topic.
Marcus, Democrats were really banking on abortion last year in the election, and with the exception of Prop 139, which did pass and passed pretty handily, it didn't really help Democrats otherwise.
No, I was going to say, if that is part of the strategy, it is a terrible strategy. It's been proven. Look, this was a strategy that was implemented by the White House to go into these swing states and come up with these measures, and they thought it would help the president and down ticket, and it didn't. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. We have a Republican Congress, Republican Senate, Republican president. The state legislature numbers went up. So if that is your strategy, I would urge you to go back to the drawing board and start focusing on, you know, those primary issues where voters were, which was immigration and the economy.
For the, like, taking the politics out of it for a minute, we'll sort of go full circle here. You know, for the groups that are advocating for this lawsuit, that are pushing this lawsuit, in their mind, you know, the constitutional amendment makes it pretty clear that these other laws should no longer be on the books. Is that a debate you think that is worth having?
Oh, you know, it's certainly a debate to have. I don't think it's as simple as just saying, hey, the voters want abortion to happen, and therefore every single abortion law that we've passed since the 1980s just needs to come off the books. This is a highly detailed process where a judge is going to have to examine each specific state statute and how that conflicts with the voter-approved measure that the voters did. And I would just guess that there are a number of those, because we've been doing this for so long, there's a number of those that are not in conflict with the measure that may stick.
Do you anticipate the question has been brought up, who's going to defend these laws? Because generally, that would be the attorney general, but she's made it pretty clear she's not going to do it. Does it seem like this is something the House Speaker, Senate President maybe step up and do?
On first glance, that's what I'm guessing is going to happen. And there's certainly been many cases where they have done that.
Yeah.
And so I will not be surprised. If not, it will be another organization.
Do you have a gut feeling as to, is this like a legislative kind of thing, maybe a private group that they would ask to do it?
I think that they'll probably, you know, kick it to a private group. I mean, one of the things that while abortion, you know, when you're having a conversation around its implications, of, you know, the election in 2024 or 2022. There's no Republican lawmaker from the president on down that wants to stand up and say that they're, you know, against women having the right, you know, to have an abortion. So I don't think that the Senate president or the Speaker of the House, they're going to want to politically put their put their political capital on a line trying to fight this.
All right. So, Reginald, speaking of legislative leadership, the House Speaker this week, they came back into session for a day, decided to take another couple weeks off. They're continuing to work on the budget, presumably some other stuff. I'm curious what you make of the fact we're, what, like 5 weeks away now from the end of the fiscal year. It seems as though budget meetings between the legislature and the governor's office have not really happened. There have been some talks that the House and Senate aren't necessarily on the same page with each other, just among Republican leadership. Are we at the point yet where we should be concerned?
Well, I would say that I could see this coming a mile away. When you have former lawmakers who were out the legislature, particularly the Republican lawmakers, who now get their shot to come back in, they've gained sort of a new sense of wisdom in the way how they want to legislate. So the idea that lawmakers in intra-caucus and then also different caucuses aren't on the same page, I think it makes sense. Will they eventually come up with something and have a conversation with the governor's office? I think so. But I do think that it is challenging. And what I'm hearing from folks is, you know, that there is some deep divides within the Republican caucus on how to spend additional revenue.
I'm curious, having served in the legislature for as long as you did, what do you make of the idea of taking a break, of not having all 90 lawmakers at the Capitol, essentially with not that much to do? Good idea, not great idea?
Well, I'll put my legislative leadership hat on for a second.
Yeah.
The worst thing that you want is a group of lawmakers with nothing to do in the building. They're just called, that's not what you want. So if you're the budget negotiation team or legislative leadership, you want to be able to actually control the environment that you're in and be able to have those conversations. But with all of the members of all of the caucus there, there's no way that they're going to have control. So, I mean, I think it's a strategy that, you know, I understand it.
Marcus, you were nodding your head as Reginald was saying you don't want all 90 lawmakers sitting around with nothing to do.
200% agree with them. You know, and as back in the good old days, I mean, when I was 25 years younger, you know, 100 days was the mark you wanted to hit, and, mm-hmm. and they were out in 100 days. And there wasn't a whole lot of grasping at straws. There wasn't huge fights. The money was the money, and what we could spend is what we could spend. In today's day and age, the only thing that helps during this process is a deadline. And the deadline for the state of Arizona is June 30th. So as the pressure starts to build, the compromise starts to build. And I think that that will be the number one motivator to getting a budget done. But I would point out that the other complicating factor in here is that revenue numbers have changed dramatically.
Yeah. And could change dramatically further.
Exactly. And so they're sort of bumping up and down. And so getting a straight line number, I would argue you really don't know where you are until June, because those are based on the May numbers to see how much revenue you actually do have to spend. And so in this particular case, I think it actually might help to go a little bit longer so you have more certainty on what those revenue numbers are.
So briefly before we go to break, Marcus, it sounds like you're not in sort of a concern point right now. Like you don't think it's a problem that we are where we are.
No, I mean, do I like it? No. You know, as I've told many of a member down there, look, if you can help a brother out, I got kids that are getting out of school, and you having to go be down here all the time while my kids are out of school is not super helpful. But I knew it was coming in January, so it's not like it's a shock to the system.
Yeah. Marcus, the big, beautiful bill, as Republicans in D.C. are calling it, has passed the U.S. House. And obviously, you know, the U.S. Senate, Republicans in the Senate are saying, you know, hold on here. They got some changes they want to make to it. But this bill, as passed, seems like it would have some pretty serious impacts on Arizona.
Oh, yeah. It's I expect a whole lot more reporting on this in the future weeks. But it's specifically because I've always said if you're going to make cuts, the stuff we've been doing on cuts and, you know, maybe the VA or other stuff that people have read about are pennies on the dollar. It's really has little to no effect, okay? And so if you've got to cut, you've got to cut in three areas. One is defense spending. Two is entitlement spending, which is Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And then three is debt payments. you know, if somehow you were able to negotiate that payment. There is huge implications on this on Medicaid, and that's healthcare for lower income Arizonans. And the numbers that we're looking at now are, I mean, there's a lot of questions. We were just talking about the state legislative budget. When you go into trying to figure out next year's budget, is there a shortfall of $2 billion or 1.9, whatever, anything above $1 billion is pretty dramatic. I'm going to tell you that right now from a budgeting standpoint. So, you know, it could be a rough next year, depending on how this goes.
Yeah, Reginald, I mean, Medicaid, food assistance, SNAP, the commonly called food stamps, like these are all programs that could see some pretty significant cuts in Arizona and elsewhere, of course.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands. I've seen numbers, you know, as high as over, you know, 500,000 to more individuals who are going to be directly impacted by no longer having health insurance. And, you know, if you're someone that's not on Medicaid, you could look at it and say, hey, this may not be directly impacting me, but I would say absolutely it's going to impact you. You know, you're going to the same hospital systems, you're seeing the same doctors. So if you have a huge percentage, you know, of individuals who no longer can use that service, it's going to actually affect the quality of care that you're able to get, which is huge. I mean, when you talk about SNAP benefits, individuals who are using those dollars to go to grocery stores and, you know, put those dollars into the economy, that's going to have a direct impact on everyone in the system. And I think that, you know, lawmakers are already hearing it. They're going to continue to hear it, that this could be, you know, closing of hospitals or clinics. And, you know, this has very wide-ranging impacts.
I just wanted to focus, because people need to get their head wrapped around how many people in Arizona are on access in the Medicaid program. And it's a substantial number. And I think that they would be shocked to learn. I mean, it's well over 30%. I can't remember the exact number. Maybe you guys know better. But it's a substantial amount of number that is on this. And so the number does need to be trimmed. I mean, it's growing at a pace that's out of control that won't be able to be sustainable. But at the same time, you have to understand that the healthcare system in Arizona is also dependent upon those dollars. And it has an adverse impact, I mean, on those hospitals, on those systems. But rural Arizona will take a particularly massive hit.
Where there's not a lot of options to begin with in many cases.
Right. And I would tell you, you know, the beloved Phoenix Children's Hospital, and I know this will shock a lot of people, is a substantial user of Medicaid dollars. One of the largest in the state, actually the largest, next to the county hospital. Mm. But they will have a massive impact on that hospital.
Marcus, we've been getting lots of emails in our inboxes from campaign committees and candidates running, talking about exactly this, about Medicaid, talking about other entitlement programs as part of this bill that Republican members from Arizona voted on. We're obviously a ways away yet from the election, and a lot can happen. But do you see this becoming a campaign issue next year?
Well, it could. I mean, look, if this bill passes in its current form, it certainly will be. I think that there's a substantial amount of members in the Senate that are looking to say, hey, you've given us a framework. Let's tune this up a little bit.
Okay.
But I would say in the current form, remember that in rural Arizona is per capita uses more federal spending than the urban core. So Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, farm, ag, all these things that we're looking at taking cuts. But those are also substantially Republican, hard-leaning conservative districts. And so politically, it's interesting to see if a voter up in Mojave County loses their health care coverage, their Social Security gets cut, Medicaid, whatever it very well may be, how does that affect their vote going into the electorate?
And I think it's going to be incumbent upon Democrats to really, you know, make that case that, you know, if you're a Mojave County individual who no longer has health insurance, you're losing it. Because an urban county, very wealthy individual has received a substantial tax cut. I mean, it's not that people are just losing health coverage just because. I mean, they're losing it because someone else is taking a tax cut. And the someone else happens to be people who can afford health care. So, I mean, it's definitely a juxtaposition.
One of the things that's contained within there is, I mean, they're looking at putting some guardrails on Medicaid. So there's a worker requirement. And Arizona's had well, attempted to do a worker requirement, I think, in the past. But some of these things, I think, are to tune up the system. And I would reiterate to people that the growth of the entitlement programs is a massive problem long term that the country can't sustain. So something has to be done.
Maybe, right? I mean, I think that's where, as a country, we kind of get in this place where, say, entitlement programs are growing. But then in the same vein, you have, you know, major folks who are trying to fight against giving people a living wage. So if you're not going to pay someone what they're worth, then of course they're going to need an entitlement. So that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, lots of discussion. I'm sure we'll continue to have that on this issue. Let me ask you, just a few minutes left. This week, not a super surprise, I think, that the Justice Department basically said we're done with the investigation into the Phoenix Police Department. They rescinded the report that found some pretty substantial constitutional violations by the Phoenix Police Department. Marcus, this is something that the Trump administration has done in other places. They kind of telegraphed that this was going to come. This is one of those issues that was kind of interesting because you had politicians from different sides of the aisle, especially in city government, all basically saying, we don't want a consent decree. We would like to be able to figure this out on our own. Where does this leave all of that, do you think, the fact that the feds are no longer really involved?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that, you know, cities that had previously gone under a consent decree were one of the first to call the city leaders and say, you do not want this. Hmm. Get out of this. Fight it as hard as you can. And it was, you know, frankly, a little bipartisan at the city.
Yeah.
You know?
It was pretty, if I'm not mistaken, it was unanimous with the city council.
We don't have that many of those moments. And so you knew something was sort of funny with that occurring. I think that the city's going to set up their own and certainly, one, get their police chief, whoever they pick, get mm-hmm. that figured out. And then, two, figure out an internal review process that works for them, that makes sense to the public, that makes sense to the city council, but doesn't put them under the thumb of a federal lawyer that you're paying for the next 50 years, millions upon millions of dollars to monitor you.
Reginald, do you think that the council is predominantly left-leaning, although there are some Republicans on it. Can they continue to find consensus, do you think, now that it's basically on the city to figure out what to do with the police department?
Yeah, I don't know if the council was predominantly left leaning. I think the council was very much in the middle. I do think, you know, based on the 2001, how we got here. You know, you have, you know, rampant use of force incidents. You had, you know, the displacement of unhoused people. The city had and the council had not shown the ability to actually create accountability and supervision. So that's why they were put here in the first place. Now, to think that the same folks who were just put under a potential decree that they're going to now be able to come back and solve it on their own, it's just, I think, is unreasonable. So the question is, what have you learned now that you didn't know before? And so, I mean, there definitely has to be some type of, you know, action. I think the community has to be involved. But the reality is the council, while I know they're well-meaning and want to make sure that they can fix this issue, they're going to have to be, you know, held. There's going to have to be some type of accountability that's being held.
From the community, you mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you think that looks like? Quickly, what do you think
Like? I think you have to make sure that there are systems in place that will allow for community members to have their voices heard, whether it's, you know, whatever the proposal is, they're actually selling it out to the community, similar to like a budget process or any other process. You need to be able to sell your plan and make sure that you get a buy-in. But, you know, just the council and the mayor alone, they can't sit in a room together and negotiate this and think that they're going to solve it. You can't have the police in the room, council, and then no one from the community.
Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Reginald Boulding, also joined by Marcus Delortino. Thanks, guys, for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.